This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Well, when was the last time you paid for something with cash? In our house, cash is something that's mostly delivered by the Tooth Fairy and used for bringing a gold coin to school on fundraising days. But with this morning's Telstra outage, maybe more of us are paying for our coffee with cash today. Good morning, Margaret Paul here on The Conversation Hour, filling in for Mary Guerin just for today. So what is the future of cash? Should we keep some in our wallets at the very least for when the technology lets us down as it has today? Maybe you've come across some businesses that won't accept cash, or maybe some that prefer cash. I want you to call in and let me know, when was the last time you used cash? Also coming up today, who's in charge of the charges? We speak to an expert who says it's far from clear who is responsible for planning Australia's network of electric vehicle charges. And that's an issue that's again been highlighted with the Telstra outage today. Maybe that's something that's stopping you from buying an EV. And coming up a bit later, we've got something a bit different, sport and sleep. I want you to tell me, are you staying up late, or maybe you're getting up early to watch Wimbledon or the World Cup? We'll bring you some practical tips on sleep so you don't feel like your eyes are being held open with matchsticks and your body's being held together with coffee. That's coming up this morning on ABC Melbourne and Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour with Margaret Paul.
Well, when was the last time you paid for something with cash? When I heard about the Telstra outage this morning, I will admit one of the first things I did was raid a piggy bank in the house for some cash, just in case I couldn't use my phone to buy a coffee, because that's pretty important to me. And it made me think we do take for granted that these online systems will just work. So maybe today the most popular people in the office this morning might be those who have some cash in their wallets to buy their colleagues a coffee. But how many of us are using cash? Does every business have to accept cash? That's what we'll be talking about this morning. We've got some issues in Victoria with the Telstra network, so you might have to bear with us. We might have some guests who are not quite ready to talk, but we'll be taking your texts and your calls this morning throughout the day. We've got a text message saying that someone just got back from Japan, or at least one of the purchases was with cash. In Japan, of course, they're a very technologically savvy country, far ahead of us. Maybe they have the right idea, says this texter. And another texter saying yesterday was the last time. We will all rue the day when cash is gone. Maybe it's something that we need to have just a bit of a backup. We've got Kevin who joins us now in Geelong. Kevin, what would you like to talk about?
I used my phone. In a rare cases, I use my card, but I don't use cash. If I go to a place and they only have cash, I walk out.
Have you ever needed to use it in an emergency and you've thought, I've only got cash on me?
Well, it's a bit difficult because I don't carry it around.
Right. So you're just relying on the phone and relying on the card?
That's correct. And oddly enough, it has happened on very rare occasions when the phone's dead or something. Well, I just can't use it. So I'm stuck.
Right, exactly, because if your phone isn't, it's not even to do with Telstra. If your phone runs out of battery or it's not charged.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. So that's kind of what we're talking about today, all the infrastructure surrounding how we pay for things and how we get around.
Spot on. If the FPOS isn't working, you can't do anything either, can you? So it does make things awkward, but it's the same. Well, you know, you could lose your wallet just as easily. It just doesn't suit my lifestyle to be carrying cash around.
I'm with you. I actually don't find that I've got cash often, but you know, it might be something that as a response to today, we're finding we're carrying it around a bit more. Thanks so much for your call, Kevin. Morgan Campbell joins us. Morgan is the head of policies at Choice, and we're going to be asking some questions about cash, how we use it, how businesses have to accept it. Good morning, Morgan Campbell. When was the last time you used cash to pay for something?
Morning, Margaret. Well, it was a couple of weeks ago to buy gelato, if you can believe it. But that was in a cafe that was cash only, which is a pretty rare thing these days. We're seeing much more often that businesses are only accepting card rather than only accepting cash. But every now and again, you go into a cash-only business, and if you're like me and don't often carry it, you end up getting caught short.
So was this a cash-only gelateria?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, near my place in Sydney, yeah. So, but pretty uncommon experience.
Amazing. So, Morgan, how many of us still use cash? It seems like it's becoming less and less common.
Yeah, it definitely is. Our survey data shows that about 65% of Australians are routinely carrying cash with them day to day. And the government's data says that around 1.5 million people are using cash to make more than 80% of their in-person payments. So that's around 1.5 million people who are still using cash pretty much all the time, which is still a lot of people.
So it's still, yeah, absolutely. It's still a lot of us who are using cash. And as we heard earlier, it might be because you don't have your wallet or your phone's run out of batteries. Stay with us, Morgan. We've got Lisa who joins us from the Grampians. Lisa, do you use cash to buy things? Tell us about your use of cash. Do you use it a lot?
Well, I do try to carry a bit of cash, certainly keep coins in the car and that sort of thing. Mm. But it seems that Stall is trying to force us out of using cash. I was in there the other day. My bank has closed down. Mm. I mean, they had an outlet in a store, which has actually closed down now. And I withdrew, $100, $250, obviously, from the ATM, different branch, went inside to get some cash because I needed to pay somebody $40 for something they'd done for me. Mm. And the bank, the big bank that I went to, said, are you one of our customers? Oh. I said, no, I'm not. But I just paid the $3.50 fee to withdraw money from their ATM. And they said, no, we don't do change unless you're one of our customers. The post office might. So I went to the post office and they said, we can't change anything under $20, over $20, unless you pay a $7 fee.
Oh, my goodness. It's becoming harder, I think, as those bank branches close. Thank you, Lisa. It's becoming harder some of us to get access to cash. Morgan Campbell is with us from Choice. Morgan, do businesses have to accept cash if we want to pay with cash?
Well, up until a little while ago, there were no businesses who had to accept cash if we wanted to pay with it. That has changed in the last few months. Basically, under the cash mandate that the government's put in place, new regulations that came into effect on the 1st of January, supermarkets and petrol stations over a certain size have to accept cash if somebody wants to pay with it. But for the rest of the economy, for every other type of business, there's no obligation on them to accept it.
Right. So it's only in certain circumstances for essentials that businesses have to accept cash. But perhaps you're more, you're less essentials like your gelato. The businesses might not have to accept cash if they have a prerogative that they want to be a cashless business. As a gelato shop, that might be a prerogative that they're able to make that decision. Is that what you're saying, Morgan?
Yeah, that's right. And like, I can accept that gelato probably not an essential. sometimes it feels like it, depending on
sure.
what type of day you're having. But a lot of things that I think most people would agree are essentials are not included in the mandate as it's drafted at the moment. So, for example, pharmacies aren't included. You've got this weird situation where you now have the right to go to a supermarket and pay cash if you need to buy paracetamol, but if you need to buy prescription medication, you don't have the right to use cash to do that. Public transport's not included, car repairs, even clothing is not included, which it's a bit of a surprise that the government doesn't think clothing is an essential, but there you go. So there's lots of things that you and I would think of as essential day-to-day items, which at the moment that legal right to carry cash doesn't include.
Such an interesting question, isn't it, around what is essential and what isn't essential. Stay with us, Morgan. We've got Gordon who joins us from Footscray West. And Gordon, what would you like to tell us about using cash?
Well, I'm vision impaired. I have a carer. She does all my shopping. She is magnificent because I can't read or write. And if I have to get anything, which is very, very seldom, the local people in the shops, Coles and so forth, I know them, and I might only carry about $10 or $20, but I do this very, very seldom. But I can't read or write, so online is absolutely impossible because I can't read or write.
Oh, it's so important, isn't it? Thank you so much, Gordon, for calling in, because I think what's essential and what's possible for some people are going to be different than what's essential and what's possible for others. Raylene joins us from Denali. Raylene, what did you want to tell us?
Hi, I'm just one of these oddities, I guess, nowadays. I pay for everything in cash. I have never sent an email. I have...
Oh, wow.
I've never done a Zoom call. I've never owned a computer. And having to pay cash for me, it actually forces me to have to get out of the house and interact with people. And for me, that's good. But yeah, it's getting harder and harder to pay with cash, and not being, connected onto the internet makes it really difficult, because everybody just assumes that you're able to do it, and that they just say, oh, no, just jump on the website and have a look. I've got no idea. I'm 55. Yeah. And I think I'm the last generation that is going to be paying with cash only.
Thank you very much for your call, Raylene. And I think it is generational. I love that you put that lovely spin on it about not being able to get out of the house and being able to talk to people if you're not necessarily buying all your clothes online or, you know, through whatever, however you buy your clothes, you're actually having to leave the house to do it. Morgan Campbell's with us still from Choice. I've got one more question for you, Morgan, which is, we've seen bank branches, and callers have alluded to this, closing across the state and across the country. Are we likely to see more businesses going cashless into the future?
Unfortunately, I think we are, particularly if there's not enough in place to prevent it. I think what your last two callers, Barbara and Gordon, have identified is some of the really important reasons that people, for one reason or other, online payments doesn't work for them, whether it's where they live. They might live in an area that doesn't have particularly good internet connection or doesn't have it at all. They might not be comfortable with online banking for one reason or another. They might find that cash helps them budget, as well as, of course, if there's an emergency or an outage like we've seen this morning, those services just aren't available. There's lots of different reasons that people need to use cash. They should have the right to use it if they need to, but they, like you say, they also need to actually be able to access it. It's not much good having the legal right to use cash if you can't get it in the first place. So, since 2017, 2,400 bank branches have closed down around Australia.
Wow.
8,600 bank-owned ATMs have gone offline at the same time. So actually accessing banking services and accessing cash is becoming harder and harder at the same time as it's becoming harder and harder to use it if you can get it.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, Morgan. That's been so interesting. Morgan Campbell's Head of Policies at Choice. We've been talking about using cash today because some of us might be using cash to get a coffee this morning because of the Telstra outage. We are bringing in Wes Lambert now. Wes Lambert is the CEO of the Australian Restaurant and Cafe Association. Let's have a look at how the outage is affecting the hospitality industry. Wes Lambert, thank you so much for joining us. I guess it's been a bit of a hectic morning for you today.
It has. Obviously, the hospitality industry, for almost every payment, 90% of payments are tap in the hospitality industry, which 20 years ago was only 10%. But before I get started, I do want to bring some potential joy to those who use cash.
Oh, we love that.
If we rewind to the 31st of March, the RBA, Michelle, made a comment when she said, we are going to end the payment surcharge on the 1st of October. And out of her own mouth, the governor of the RBA said, and we encourage a cash discount. Now, I can tell you that ARCA is working with a premium ATM company, not expensive, but premium, to bring back the ATM in restaurants, cafes, and retail businesses and news agents around Australia, because businesses cannot absorb the merchant fee. They cannot absorb it. So why not give a cash discount and have an ATM in the corner so patrons can get money out if they want to?
Because
it's very inexpensive now to have an ATM installed, and the business can actually put the cash back into the ATM. There are many of options to do that. So we're voting for cash.
So don't throw out the $20 notes just yet. They're going to come in useful. Wes, tell us what's going on with the hospitality hospitality industry this morning with this outage. I imagine it's been pretty chaotic across the hospitality industry. What's the latest there?
Well, it is, because 90% of transactions are done with tap and go. And so many businesses don't have a lot of cash on hand, right? They don't have a lot of change on hand. The float that might be in the drawer is certainly not enough to handle, the type of volume of transactions that are obviously coming through because of Telstra's mismanagement of the network. Ultimately, we're already getting calls, our phones blown up to, how do we do this? How do we do that? Bookings, people usually call on bookings. So anyone who, has a mobile number for that or uses a Telstra landline for that, there's a bit of chaos in the industry. Cafes a little less affected, but restaurants, especially those that take bookings, and certainly, the morning breakfast rush, it's been, does anybody have any change?
And I guess, would you be calling on people as they're going about paying for their Eggs Benedict? We know there's a very strong cafe culture here in Melbourne and a very strong restaurant culture, as you've alluded to. I guess you'd be calling on people just to be patient because everyone's trying their best. Is that, we don't want to see aggro across the industry, do we, today?
No, I think as a consumer, you should probably hit an ATM, preferably a bank ATM, on your way, and get some cash out, because you just don't know what business may or may not have been restored. The phone companies will often tell us that blah percent has been restored, but it's not the blah percent in your neighborhood. And so it's really important that you stop and get cash and have that with you for the next few days, because with many of these outages, we've often seen the same problem happen again and again over a few days before it's actually ironed out.
I love that. Just a bit of advice for everyone, just to be prepared, bring some cash with you and be prepared and be patient and be kind. Thank you so much for joining us, Wes. That's Wes Lambert, who's the CEO of the Australian Restaurant and Cafe Association. I'm Margaret Paul. This is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up, we're talking about how this Telstra outage is playing havoc with our transport systems. We've been talking about the V-Line, but even some electric vehicle chargers are also affected. So we're going to talk about the infrastructure we all rely on to get around. That's coming up on ABC Melbourne and Victoria.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
Now, a question that's likely to affect most of us, if it hasn't already, who's in charge of the chargers? And I'm talking about the electric vehicle charging network that's rolling out across Victoria. You might have seen maybe a car next to a footpath with a cable running across the footpath as people try to charge their cars on the street. But with the cost of batteries and running costs plunging, sales of EVs are outperforming petrol cars across Europe and Asia. So will we be seeing more of those cables across the footpath in Australia as people try to charge their cars outside their homes? And who's responsible for thinking about this? Call in and tell me what you think. Someone who's been thinking about this is Hussein Dia, who's the Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at Swinburne University of Technology. Hussein, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
First, I have to ask, with your transport technology hat on, I have to ask about the impact of the Telstra outage this morning, because we've been hearing about people waiting long lines and running for buses because of the V-Line trains that are out. How does the Telstra outage mean that Victoria's regional train network is down? How does that work?
So rail operations depend on dedicated communication systems that allow the drivers of the trains to communicate with the network control centers to stay in contact and operate the services safely. My understanding is that the part of that communication network has been down. It relies on Telstra. As our transport networks become more digital and connected, they need these communication systems. But I think there are issues with the way they have been designed. They need to be designed to tolerate faults without bringing an entire network to a standstill.
Yes, it does. It does seem like there might need to be some revision of that, because it doesn't seem like it's working very well out there this morning. We've also heard that there might be some EV charging stations that are down as well because of this morning's Telstra outage. What can you tell us about that?
So exactly. So since the morning with the V-line, apparently the outage has impacted other systems. And that is an issue with EV charging stations as well. We have a number of operators, private operators who run these chargers. And also it depends who are they, you know, providing their services for telecommunication with, because, you know, they also rely on apps and so forth. It is really a connected energy, electricity, and telecommunication system. It is a bit of a problem in some states, for example, in Tasmania and in Western Australia. There is one company, ChargeFox, who is actually providing most of the infrastructure for charging. So that becomes a problem. And this is, you know, this is exactly what has happened in this case, is that if one network provider is down, it can bring most of the network across the state down with it.
So it's a problem if that infrastructure is too centralized, because it means if one network goes down and that's the network we're relying on, then you'd see all these other problems. Can you paint a bit of a broader picture for us now about the charging network overall? Is it basically a hodgepodge? You've mentioned Tasmania there being a bit more centralized, but for the rest of mainland Australia, what is the charging network like now?
So the public charging network is really expanding rapidly, as you said in your introduction. I mean, now one in four new vehicle sales in Australia are battery EVs, and one in two almost vehicle sales have some sort of electrification, battery, hybrid, etc. The charging network is trying to keep up, expanding rapidly, but it's happening in a haphazard way. We have them on major highways, we have them in shopping centers, and increasingly, as you mentioned, on local streets. We have around 1,300 public charging stations around the country. More than 50% of them are fast chargers. If you live in an urban area, you have probably a charger within 5 kilometers. People living in regional areas are more impacted. It is really very sporadic and not as good as in urban areas.
It does sound like a bit of a hodgepodge. So if there's no federal oversight and it's regulated and perhaps implemented largely at a local network, I know in where I live, the council operates EV chargers at the swimming pool, for example, so you can charge your car while you're, you know, taking the kids to the pool for a swimming lesson. But what's the future here? Does there need to be more of a more oversight from a federal perspective? What needs to happen?
Not necessarily a federal perspective. I think we just need an authority or an organization that can coordinate things. So at the moment, we have the Commonwealth providing the national policy direction. They provide like the EV plan, and also they provide funding. You have the local councils identifying good locations. We have the electricity distributors. We have the regulators like the Australian Energy Regulator and the Market Commission. However, we don't have someone that is looking and saying, how do we make all chargers communicate on the same app?
Right.
Or, you know, things like this. And we've done this before. Your listeners might remember maybe 10 years ago, we used to go around with multiple electronic tags on our windscreens, because if you traveled in New South Wales, you needed one. If you traveled in Victoria, you needed another one. Now, you know, since then, the industry got its act together, and now everyone in Australia has just the one single electronic tag, and they can travel on any toll road. We need something similar.
I mean, it's not unlike a telecommunications network, is it? I mean, to bring the flavour of the day to this issue, it's an essential infrastructure that people will use around the country, regardless of which state they're in. What can we learn from other countries? Because I know that China has a very interesting solution for electric trucks, which is obviously becoming more of an issue, isn't it?
That's right. So that is a bigger issue, because they need faster chargers, you know, for heavy vehicles. And there are other solutions. Instead of charging, there is battery swapping. So, you know, the vehicle can go into a warehouse, and within 5 minutes, a robot would replace the whole battery and put in a new one. And, you know, within 5 minutes, people can be on their way. I think what we can learn from other nations as well, like the Netherlands and Norway, who are leading in this space, is that we need to have legislation enacted to allow people living in apartments to give them the right to own and install a charger. Because at the moment, in many places in Australia, apartment dwellers are not allowed to do this. And this is where they rely on, charging, public charging infrastructure, like you said, near the swimming pool. In order to address this, other nations have resorted to the pole-mounted chargers, the ones you mentioned as well. But we need to be a little bit more organized. We don't want to end up in a solution where we have something similar to a petrol station. This is, when I talk to people, they say, well, I don't want to spend 30 minutes in a petrol station. I want, when I go to my post office, when I go to do my local shopping, when I have a coffee with my friends, I leave my car parked for an hour, 2 hours. This is when I would like it to be charged.
Yes, I think we can all agree that the charging has to be where it has to be, where people's cars are. So I think that's why shopping centres, in outside your home, the swimming pool, the library, maybe those kinds of things are really useful. Just on the text line, we've got they should ban the use of apps in Australia for EV charging. It should all be done by credit card, which is an interesting way of looking at it. And someone else says, I'm guessing a fair few petrol stations aren't working this morning with no way to pay. So why pick on electric vehicle charging? I think it's a really interesting question. Yeah. We're looking at that whole infrastructure, aren't we? Hussein Dia, thank you so much for joining us. That's been a really interesting discussion. Hussein Dia is the Professor of Transport Technology and Sustainability at Swinburne University of Technology. You're listening to Margaret Paul with The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up, are you up late watching the tennis, the Tour de France or the World Cup? We need to get some tips on how to survive this sporting storm, or maybe it's just your life when you can't get enough sleep. That's coming up on ABC Melbourne and Victoria.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
The Men's Soccer World Cup is in full swing. Wimbledon is underway. And then there's the Tour de France. Let's talk about the impact on all this sport on your sleep. Are you setting the alarm to get up early? Maybe you're pulling an all-nighter because you've got to watch it live. Let's get some advice on how to do this healthily. I want you to call in if you've got some questions on the best way to nap or whether it's better to just pull an all-nighter or set the alarm for the middle of the night. Sally Ferguson, Professor Sally Ferguson, joins us now. Sally Ferguson is the director of the Appleton Institute, which is a research institute that looks at health and well-being at work, rest and play at CQ Uni. Sally, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Most welcome, Margaret.
Sally, how bad for us is it just to let sport dictate our sleep patterns for a while? Can we just give up on sleep for the duration of Wimbledon? It's only a couple of weeks. Surely we can just pull through.
Oh, Margaret, what a great question. I'm a massive sport fan and sleep is my research life. So this is a real conundrum for people like myself and many others. Giving up on sleep for the 2 weeks of Wimbledon, I think, is probably not advisable.
Okay, thank you. let's get that out of the way.
Start there, yep. Sleep is very important for our health and our well-being and our performance, our concentration, our mood, all sorts of things. We need sleep for all kinds of reasons. And so if we were just to go without sleep for 2 weeks, well, we would be useless and probably a bit dangerous and quite unhealthy. So, no, we need a different strategy.
Okay. All right. We'll forget that one. We won't just give up on sleep until we know who wins Wimbledon. So what's the best way to do it? What are some strategies? Should we be pulling an all-nighter or should we set the alarm early? We had the Socceroos playing at 4 a.m. recently, which is a difficult time because do you just push through till 4 or do you get a bit of sleep early and then set the alarm? What's the best way to do it?
Yeah, so this is my answer to a lot of these sorts of questions, Margaret. It depends, and it depends on a few things. Probably the main thing is what you need to be doing the next day. Mm. If you need to be up and functioning the next day after the Socceroos have played with a 4 a.m. start, then getting as much sleep before they start, before the game, would be the best advice, and then getting up early. If you don't need to do too much the next day, and maybe you're a night owl, so you can stay up till 4 4 o'clock, I can't, then maybe you do push through and then you sleep after the game. Or perhaps if you're on afternoon shift and you can stay up and watch it. So yeah, it really depends a little bit on what you need to be doing the next day, whether you will have a chance for a recovery nap, depending on what you're doing. But I think for a 4 a.m. start, probably going to bed early and as early as possible, and waking up is the best thing to do for that one.
I love that recognition that we're all geared a bit differently. For me personally, if I saw 4 a.m., that I'm not pulling an all-nighter. I'm setting the alarm because I like going to bed early. That's fine with me. Yeah. But for some people, it would be an all-nighter. Now, you mentioned the nap in there. We need to talk about the best way to nap. Is it 20 minutes, half an hour? Do we have a coffee beforehand, afterwards? Talk us through the best way to deal with a recovery nap, Sally.
Yeah, so there are lots of options there, Margaret. And again, it depends. It depends how much time you've got for a start to have a nap. If you've only got half an hour, then take 20 minutes and set your alarm and get 20 minutes. 20 minutes will give you a good boost in alertness and performance. If you can have the coffee before and then immediately fall asleep or lie down and try and sleep, that's been termed a nappuccino. Great name. Not mine, so I should cite the source. But that gives you a little extra boost because you can get to sleep, have the nap before the caffeine effects take hold, and then you get like a little double boost. If you've pulled an all-nighter because that's the way you're designed or that's the way your life works, then a couple of hours the next day for a restorative nap, get some deep sleep, might be a better option as well. So, yeah, again, it depends how much time you've got and what do you got to do after.
I love that. These tips are, of course, applicable if you're up late or early to watch the sport, but also if you're, you know, cramming for a uni exam, perhaps you've got young children, you're a shift worker, there are many reasons why we might need some tips on sleep. We're talking with Professor Sally Ferguson, who's the director of the Appleton Institute at CQ University, on the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I have one idea. Mm. If you're listening to sport and you're going to follow it for the whole time, what if you just acclimatise to the local time zone? What if you just went, I'm watching the Tour de France, I live in France for 2 weeks in Melbourne, I'm just going to live by that local clock. Would that work?
Well, but essentially turning yourself into a night shift worker. I'm not sure what you're doing for a job. But anyway, if you're going to do that, maybe you've taken some leave. Mm. Yes, you could do that. The only so you could be awake at night watching the Tour de France and then attempting sleep during the day. Mm. The challenge there is that depending on when you are seeing daylight, your body clock might not actually shift. So if you went to France, which that's probably the ideal situation to watch the Tour de France, if you travel to France, then your body clock will adapt over a couple of days and you will synchronise to the time in France. Excuse me, Margaret.
I like that idea, Professor Sally Ferguson, because it's almost like taking a little mini holiday. You're moving to France. You're kind of, you're acclimatizing to the time zone and enjoying the landscape. And we did get a text reminding us about the Tour de France, the biggest cycling race in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled that we can talk a bit more about the Tour de France. I just wanted to ask too about the athletes. We're talking with Professor Sally Ferguson. I want to ask about the athletes because it's one thing for us to sit on the couch with a cup of tea and a blanket. Mm. But how does changing time zones affect these athletes who are perhaps flying across the world to compete at a very high level? Their sleeps would be interrupted too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so some of the teams in the Appleton and others around the country do a lot of work with athletes and sleep from a couple of different perspectives. So one is the travel. International athletes competing in competitions will usually travel several weeks, if possible, ahead of the competition so that they actually have time to get through the jet lag. They'll also go with jet lag plans that mean that they might start synchronising to the new time zone before they actually leave. They'll be sleeping and awake during the travel phase to maximise the speed at which their clocks actually resynchronise to the new time zone, and then getting used to the new environment. We also work with athletes who play their sport or compete into the night hours. So even if you're playing, you know, a game of netball at night, it can take a while after after the game's finished to do all your wind down, your recovery, and then actually get to sleep. And so athletes are always dealing with challenges to their sleep. And because we know that sleep is so important for performance, including physical performance, everyone is very tuned into it now. So, yes.
Thank you so much for that. Professor Sally Ferguson, the director of the Appleton Institute, which is a research institute that looks at health and well-being at work, rest and play at CQ Uni. I think what we've all learned is we cannot take sleep for granted. I probably am going to forego my third coffee for the day with that reminder from you. So thank you so much for joining us, Sally Ferguson, for that discussion about sleep.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
I'm Margaret Paul. This is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We've got Leanne joining us on the line. We've been talking today about cash. Leanne, what did you want to say about cash?
We've just done a 10-day road trip. We went up to Canberra for 5 days and then we went down along the New South Wales coast. And over that 10 days, we paid cash the whole way, and all the smaller towns were very grateful for the cash. But the thing that was alarming was when we were at Parliament House, we bought some souvenirs and they asked if we could pay cash, not card.
Oh, that's interesting, because we were talking earlier about whether you were able to use your card at all times or whether sometimes you were able to use cash. So you've found it's been different as you travel around Australia, Leanne?
Yeah. So a lot of the places would say cash or card and we would say cash and they were very grateful. But it was more Parliament House. They requested we pay cash, not card, in their gift shop.
They requested cash in the gift shop. Very interesting. And we've heard a bit about those new regulations that come in that mean businesses that are offering essential services like groceries and petrol, they will have to accept cash, but that option remains available to businesses who are selling, you know, souvenirs, gelati, other non-essential items, that it's really up to them how they choose to do that. So thank you so much for calling in, Leanne. You're listening to The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Coming up today, do you have a favourite footy top? Maybe you've been inspired by the all-white at Wimbledon. We've been talking about staying up late watching the tennis. Maybe you wear a yellow jersey because you like watching the Tour de France. Coming up, we're going to talk about the impact of sport on fashion. That's on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Margaret Paul.
A couple of texts for you. We've got, we'd like some tips on handling a 7-hour time zone shift for international travel. Do you just give up on the lost sleep? That's a really good question. We had our sleep expert on this morning and I didn't see that text in time. But for many of us who have done that international travel, you kind of just have to acclimatise to where you are, don't you? And I think that tip about, you know, don't give up on the sleep. Get outside and get some fresh air as well. I think that always helps me. We're talking this morning about sleep. We're talking about cash because we've been impacted with the Telstra outage that's been happening today. Anyone who doesn't carry cash, this is on the text line, anyone who doesn't carry cash is a fool, and any physical business that doesn't accept cash is dangerous. Banks and financial institutions cannot restrict what you spend your cash on. That's come in on the text line this morning. Yeah, I think we've learned today that perhaps the people who have got cash this morning that are ready to shout their colleagues a coffee might be a bit more popular in the office today because of that Telstra outage. And keep listening to ABC Radio this morning. We'll keep you updated on the latest on that Telstra outage. We'll be speaking soon to Jai Marshall, who's a fashion designer and lecturer in fashion at Swinburne University. But I'd love to get your calls and texts as well. Jai Marshall he joins us now, fashion designer and lecturer in fashion at Swinburne. Jai, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
Before we get to him, though, I want you to call in and tell me, do you have a favourite item of clothing that's inspired by sports? Perhaps a footy scarf or a nice pair of sneakers? I've got my sneakers on today, but I wouldn't say they're particularly fashionable. Jai Marshall, we understand that there are fashion houses dressing the national sporting squads. Who are some of those fashion houses and why are fashion houses involved in rugby jumpers or Olympic athletes' uniforms?
Yeah, it's been really interesting. The World Cup has become a really powerful intersection between sport, fashion and identity. And we're really seeing that no longer footy shorts just simply for supporter wear, but they're actually starting to creep into,
cultural objects and expression of national pride, and as well as just everyday streetwear. And we've been seeing some really awesome collaborations between some of those national sport sports jerseys and brands, such as Jacquemus and the French football team, or whether it's Drake and the Canadian team. It's been really interesting to see that no longer are these footy jerseys just staying in the stadium, but they're coming out into our everyday streetwear.
I think that's for sure. I think we can all remember when the Matildas were playing. We saw a lot of Matildas uniforms on the streets of Melbourne. And of course, we always see the footy scarves on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday night around Melbourne. What are some of the standout uniforms? What are some of the things that we're looking for when we are talking about that kind of next level of fashion design when it comes to athletes' uniforms?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Melbourne actually does it quite well with AFL and the pride around some of those jerseys. But I think the clubs that have got it really right for this particular World Cup is really being able to have that mix between keeping that national pride and having a real unique twist. It's been really interesting to see a lot of TikTokers coming in and upcycling old jerseys or styling it with everyday shorts or pants. It's been so great to see so much inspiration and creativity happening around these places. I do think my personal favourite is probably Jacquemus and the French football team. I think they took a very minimalistic approach, but that's such a French luxurious pride to their sport.
I love that idea of the vintage too, because I know sometimes I am a bit of an op shopper. You go into an op shop and you see the kind of, you know, the Carlton jersey from the 1980s. I'm not a Carlton fan, so I'm not obviously not going to buy it and wear it, but it speaks you a little bit, doesn't it? There's something really nice about that that vintage wear, I guess, when we come to sports. Is this a new thing? When did we start seeing a blend of elite sports and global fashion? Is that something that's been around for a while, or is it old as the hills?
It has been around for quite a while. When we think of Richmond Football Club and Puma and Collingwood and Nike, every AFL club has a kind of sports fashion partnership. But we haven't seen it so much in the world world football, in the World Cup. And this is kind of a new revolution of real people coming in and thinking about new commercialised ways of selling these sportswear. But I really do think that people are just really proud about their nations and are actually really in love with just the elements of design that are happening in those particular partnerships. I think it's going beyond just sports. People are actually finding it a real new sports micro trend.
Yeah, and it goes to that national pride as well. It's kind of, it goes to your identity, your sports team, your nation that's representing you at the World Cup. We've got this coming on the text line from Danny on 0437 774 774. Danny says, please don't tell me that tight, revealing Warwick Kappa footy shorts are coming back. That would be very scary. I don't think that's exactly what we're talking about, but who knows? I'm happy to see where this conversation takes us. We've gone soccer, we've gone footy, but we need to talk about the tennis. We've got Wimbledon, where Naomi Osaka's been rocking some extraordinary outfits. Jai Marshall joins us. He's a fashion designer and lecturer in fashion at Swinburne. Jai, can you describe some of the outfits that Naomi Osaka's been rocking at Wimbledon, please?
I think the best description is haute couture. This is just beyond everyday fashion, but it's an artwork. And I think this new tunnel fashion, I'm all on board for it. It's kind of come out of nowhere, but it's really these sports players playing towards their personalities and making sure that they're going to shine on the court, but also off the court. And I think, particularly with Naomi, I think it might also be something to kind of scare her teammates or competitors away.
You've said that this is not a new phenomenon, but the tunnel fits. Explain what that is, because that is a new phenomenon, isn't it?
Yeah, the tunnel fashion is quite brand new, and really we started to see this with Naomi and the China jellyfish outfit previously. And it is really about, tennis players coming through that tunnel as they're about to enter the sport in some really interesting fashion pieces that are capturing so much global attention. And we wouldn't call this typical fashion, we'd call this haute couture, which is really fashion, which has a great craftsmanship, a level of detail. Some people might find it a little bit outrageous and silly. individually, but it is really just playing to the character of the athlete.
I love that. I love any chance for athletes to inject a bit of personality. You know, we in the media we get sick of the athletes talking about taking it one day at a time. So any chance for them to show a bit of personality, I am all for it. Talk to me about the kinds of fabrics, because that's really interesting too. I think we're seeing a bit of a resurgence of wool. Talk to us about that. What kind of fabrics are we seeing at the moment?
Yeah, sports performance is really interesting. In the past, we've always had natural fibres in sportswear, but now we're seeing a lot more synthetic fibres or man-made fibres, which is really interesting because man-made or synthetic fibres, which are generally plastics, polyesters, polyamides, hold a lot more bacteria and are a great breeding ground for microbacteria. And there's a really direct correlation between smelly clothes and the growth of bacteria, where natural fibres... They kind of take on water and they're not made of long chains of carbon and hydrogen, and therefore it's a little bit easier. We can probably wear natural fibres a few days before washing them, where synthetic fibres, we really have to wash them after every time that we've exercised to get rid of those bacteria that's spreading across some of those chemical chains. And therefore, that's why we've seen this real new uptake of natural fibres such as wool, which is a great Australian national fibre because it is naturally breathable and odour resistant and doesn't grow some of those bacteria such as the synthetic fibres.
I can't believe we've got all the way to the end of the discussion about fashion and sport and we're only now talking about washing your sports clothes and how to do that safely. We could do a whole other issue on this. But I understand Jai Marshall, who fashion designer and lecturer at Swinburne. You've got an announcement coming out today about fashion manufacturing. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, later today, the Australian Fashion Council are going to announce that they're doing a national smart clothing factory feasibility study. And we're looking at what a smart fashion factory might look like here in Australia and kind of trying to make a bit of a case for an investment in this factory. So anybody listening who has any involvement in fashion or fashion manufacturing, we really invite anybody to join the Australian Fashion Council co-design workshops to put some input about what the future of manufacturing might look like here in Australia, which is really exciting because it's the first time we've talked seriously about onshore manufacturing since the removal of the tariffs way back in the 1970s.
That's awesome. And we know that wool has been a really significant part of our manufacturing industry here in Victoria. So thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. That's Jai Marshall, fashion designer and lecturer in fashion at Swinburne. We've gone footy shorts, we've gone footy tops, we've been to, and I'm told by Colin on the text line that it is a Guernsey, not a jersey in the AFL. So thank you so much for calling in, Colin. Thanks for your time, Jai Marshall. We'll let you get on with observing all those amazing tunnel fits out at Wimbledon.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Amazing. We've got a quick call about sleep because we've been talking about how to stay up late and watch all these amazing sports. So Terry in Box Hill, you wanted to talk about a quick...
Yeah, just a bit of more advice that if you... don't want to stay up late and watch the Tour de France or the tennis, record it or watch it on a playback system, you know, because then you can watch it at your own time and not be sleep deprived.
Terry, that's extremely practical of you and I respect the practicality. But for people who are really sports obsessed, doesn't that take the fun out of it? Isn't it all about watching it live and being at the same time as everyone else?
It's great if you can do that. But I mean, okay, I'm semi-retired, so I can go to bed whenever I want. But if you're working, it's very difficult. I remember someone at work, he came in late because he'd watched the cricket all night.
Terry, thank you so much for your call. I agree. It's one of those issues where it kind of depends on what you're doing the next day, doesn't it? How much you can get away with staying up late and watching the sports. Thanks so much for calling in, Terry. Thanks so much for your time today. I'm Margaret Paul. Kirsten Diprose is back with you tomorrow for The Conversation Hour. Thanks for joining me on The Conversation Hour today. You can listen again by finding The Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app. Have a great afternoon. I'm Margaret Paul on ABC Radio, Melbourne and Victoria.